Tony, did you get the extra premium gas that I asked for this week?
I did. I got your text last night, and I filled up this morning, and it was, you know, it is really hard to find a gas station, especially in Ottawa, that sells extra premium gas. But why do we need that?
Well, we're going to a time and a place that I think the Wayback Machine needs it. The Wayback Music Machine needs it, because we're going back a long time ago.
Oh, well, I can't wait, because we've been back pretty far, but never more than about maybe 60, 70 years. Are we going back further than that?
Yes, we're going back more than 100 years.
Oh, that's very exciting. All right, let's do it. So I've got the Wayback Music Machine fueled up, and here we go. Maps?
Check.
Snacks?
Double check.
Tunes?
Check.
I'm Tony Stewart.
I'm Aaron Badgley.
And we are cruising the rock and roll highway in our Wayback Music Machine. Are you ready, my friend?
I sure am.
I have the feeling this is going to be the start of a great adventure.
Kind of a magical mystery tour.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that. So it looks like we're going to Michigan, and in fact, we're going to Kalamazoo in 1902. How do you like that rhyme?
Thumbs up. You're a poet and didn't know it.
All right. So we've even got the budget for increased sound effects, so you don't need to tap your fingers. I'm going to cue it up for you, but can you punch it in anyway?
Yeah, I'm punching it in.
All right. Here we go. Oh, man, I forgot that they only have dirt roads in 1902.
And Tony, watch out for the horse. The horse.
Oh, whew, that was close. You know, I certainly want to make sure that people know that no animals were harmed in the recording of this episode.
The car, I don't know, but the animals are fine.
Well, the extra premium fuel held up. So here we are, Kalamazoo, Michigan, 1902. And actually, this has a direct impact on rock and roll history. All joking aside, this was the day, October 10th, 1902, that the Gibson Mandolin / Guitar Company was formed. And, you know, Gibson, of course, went on to produce some of the finest electric guitars. And their first one was the ES-150 in 1936. And in 1946, they introduced a model called the P-90, which had a single coil pickup. And eventually, the one that is prized by all collectors, the Les Paul model, made in 1952. And what an impact that had on rock and roll history.
Oh, I mean, how many classic records are based around a riff played on a Les Paul or even an acoustic? I mean, Gibson didn't... I mean, Orville Gibson had no idea what he was creating when he... You're a musician. Would you say Gibsons are good guitars?
They are fantastic guitars. And I'll get into that in a bit because, you know, there were two competing manufacturers, basically, and then everybody else copied them, right? Gibson and Fender. And there's some big differences between them. But Orville started right with a single-piece mandolin. And it was more durable than other mandolins available, and it could be manufactured in volume. You know, I guess it's very similar to what Henry Ford did with the automobile, right? He was mass producing mandolins and then started experimenting with putting pickups on these things and electrifying them, and started in a one-room workshop. Isn't that hard to believe? In Kalamazoo, Michigan.
It's amazing.
And of course, it started that they only produced his original designs, but after he died in 1918, I mean, they had other designers on board, and of course, that famous collaboration with Les Paul. And just listen to some of these players, Aaron, who've played on the Les Paul models. So Jimmy Page, / Randy Rhodes, Pete Townsend, Dwayne Allman, Billy Gibbons. I mean, what a who's who, right?
Now, when you've been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, right?
Yes.
Did you see the Les Paul exhibit?
I did. And amazing. And what a pioneer, you know?
Oh, just incredible. And to think that he built on what Gibson had started, right?
Well, that's right. And, you know, the big difference, Gibson's, I mean, I'm no guitar expert by any means, but the big difference, you know, was always I mean, the body shape was different from what Fender was doing, right? But the other difference was is that Gibsons still are crafted out of one piece of wood, right? So the neck stock is not bolted on. Like Fender's, the neck is bolted on. But on a Gibson, it is actually this, you know, one piece of wood, right? It's all crafted.
I never knew that. I did not. Like that's to today. Like if you buy an acoustic Gibson or whatever, it's just going to be one piece.
Well,
one
I know for their electrics it is, yeah.
Wow. And, that's pretty cool, man.
It is. So you can actually tell. You can look when you turn a Fender over, you can see where the neck is bolted on, right? And so, I mean, there's arguments for both sides. I think a lot of Gibson musicians feel like the entire instrument resonates better because it's one piece of wood. Whereas the Fender guys will say that with the removable neck, you can just swap out the neck if it bows or something like that, right? If you can't fix the bowing in it. So, I mean, both guitars had incredible impact on rock and roll history, but Gibson has innovated constantly over the years, starting with mandolins, but the collaboration with Les Paul, as we said. And I actually got to try one of the cooler Gibson guitars. They developed an auto-tuning system. They nicknamed it the robot guitar. And how it works, I mean, it looks like a regular Gibson electric guitar with a little electronic attachment up near the end where the tuning pegs are on. Mm-hmm. And you strum a string and the guitar tunes itself and you can see the pegs turning. And it takes about 2 or 3 seconds.
Really? I think I've seen people, I mean, when you describe it, it sounds like something I've seen.
Yeah, so it's an auto-tuning guitar, and you can even do the different tunings that some musicians use. Like if you want drop D tuning, you can have it do that as well. And I got to play a very early one. It was actually the serial number on it was like, you know, 007 or whatever. So it was the seventh one. And my brother-in-law is a collector, and he had number 7 off the line. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. You know, and you know, Tony, you can tune a guitar, but you can't tune a fish.
Wah, wah, wah. Well,
I couldn't resist.
But, you know, this the legacy of Gibson with their guitars and the players who continue to this day. Now, that company has had their ups and downs, and, you know, they filed for bankruptcy protection again as late as 2018. I mean, it's a little bit sad, but guitar playing is waning a bit, right? So I don't know who to blame that on, whether to blame that on streaming or blame it on cell phones or what, but the number of young kids who are picking up guitars, you certainly aren't seeing it like you used to, you know?
No. Well, it's computers too, right? I mean, you can buy, you know, I was at a show on Sunday. And two guys were doing Beatles songs. They were the opening act, but they had everything on their computer as backing tapes.
Yeah,
the drums. And I just thought, it's not quite the same.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, at the risk of insulting somebody here, when you are using a backing track like that, to me, that's karaoke. But you know, that's
what I called it.
Okay. So apologies to anybody out there, but I'm old school about that. I like to see someone who's actually put the time and effort to learn their instrument and learn their craft. But it is there are less and less kids playing guitar, and hopefully that trend will change, you know, because there is a demand for all things retro. So maybe the guitar will be looked at as retro in a little while and kids will pick it up again, you know?
But there were a lot of copycats of Gibson too, right? I mean, you sometimes you see a guitar, you go, "Well, that's a Gibson," but really, it's not.
Yeah, Gibson. Tons of companies have copied their body style, and originally they only manufactured under the Gibson name, but then they licensed it out. There's a company called Epiphone, which you know, it's like a cheaper version of Gibson. And I actually bought an Epiphone for my son when he started guitar lessons, but.
Both my girls have one, yeah.
Yeah, and Gibson bought them out, and I mean, they bought a bunch of guitar companies, but for sure, there's all kinds of different brand names, but there's that body style that you know it's a Gibson, yep. Now, I'm very curious, Aaron. Back in 1902, I have a sneaking suspicion that you must have found some charts. So what kind of charts did you find for then?
Really old charts and really interesting things, Tony. So
I can't wait.
And I'm... you and I share a lot in common. We have a lot of the similar tastes and viewpoints, and both of us share a passion for history, right?
Yes.
So it's interesting that in 1902, Belle Bailey, Won't You Come Home, was a brand new song. And it was a previous number one. It was number five by a guy named Huey Cannon. Now, Huey was a smart guy. In 1903, he released a song called I Wonder Why Bill Bailey Hasn't Come or Won't Come Home. Smart guy. Number four was Sousa, John Sousa and his band with Jack Tar March.
Yeah, the March King, John Philip Sousa. Yep.
Yeah, but it was him. You know, it just floors me. Number three was, I love this song and I love the title, The Beer That Made Milwaukee Famous by Dan Quinn. Now, this was released only on an Edison cylinder. You know those old things, folks,
yeah,
where they, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And number two and one was the same song by different artists, which is, okay. It's a song called The Mansion of Aching Hearts, which sounds like a Hank Williams title.
Yeah.
Number two is by Byron G. Harlan. And number one was Harry McDonough. And both of those were single-sided 78s. In other words, just you had the A side, nothing on the B side.
Now, who was tracking charts back then? Like, was it
Billboard.
It was still Billboard, back then.
Billboard started off tracking circuses.
Yeah.
But by 1902, by the early 1900s, 1899, you know, sheet music was selling, and I mean that's how these are combined sheet music and record sales, right? So, mm-hmm. And they started looking at the Edison discs. I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I've got one of the original Edison 10-inch discs that was a precursor to 78s, and it's got the French national anthem on one side, and the Russian national anthem on the other side.
Oh, that's very, very cool. Yeah. And you were saying number five was Bill Bailey, "Won't You Please Come Home," right?
Yeah.
I think I told you what I saw a little while ago. I saw a video of a screen test by Anne Margaret singing Bill Bailey, Won't You Please Come Home, and dancing along with it. It was fantastic.
You have to send that to me. I forgot about that. You got to send that to me.
Yes. And we were saying, you know, can you imagine if Anne Margaret and Elvis would have had children? Like, my goodness.
They would have taken over the world.
Oh, my goodness. Talk about two beautiful people. Now, we are going to be jumping, and we're going across the pond, aren't we, to England, and we're going to be talking about a very special and interesting Top of the Pops situation that developed. But so we have to go to October the 9th, 1969.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right, let's do it. So let's jump across the pond. Here we go.
The following contains adult situations.
And listener discretion is advised.
Just kidding. we're here in 1969, Tony, to look at an episode of Top of the Pops where they refused to air the number one song because they banned it. Do you know the name of that song and the artist?
Well, I've got the name of the song right here, which the name is pretty innocuous, right? It is Je T'aime, Moi Non Plus, and it's Serge Gainsbourg and Jane Birkin who did that, didn't they?
Mm.
They did a lot of things.
Yeah.
This is a very strange story, folks.
Yeah, it doesn't get much odder than that. I mean, first of all, the melody is quite nice. I quite like the melody, but it's the, you know, I tell you honestly, the first time I ever heard my mother walked in the room and it was on the radio, and I got embarrassed. I mean,
are you going to be able to put this on the Spotify playlist?
Of course. It's you know, I mean, compared to some of the other stuff coming out now, it's, well, maybe not. I don't know. It's fun.
We should
so
tell
folks,
people.
We're talking about what's that?
Oh, I'm saying we should tell people what we're talking about. Yeah.
Have you ever heard? Okay, so it's a song that they put out, Je T'aime, which was basically an instrumental with Serge and Jane professing their love for each other during a rather intimate act. they were apparently recorded it in the act of love and superimposed it over the top of the song. And it was a massive, massive hit. Although the record company, and your notes, Tony, they actually dropped it, didn't they?
They dropped it because of the stir in Britain, right? And but it went all the way to number two, didn't it?
I laughed, actually, in your notes where you said it was the first French language. What words? I'm just asking, what words are actually in the song?
Yeah, no kidding, eh? But it was, what a story, right? Let's just record ourselves having sex and let's splice it in and, you know, just give it that extra je ne sais quoi.
Ooh, very nice. Very nice. Well, I would love to hear the original version with Brigitte Bardot.
Yes.
So there's two Beatle connections. Okay. You want the Beatle connections?
Yeah.
Okay. Jane Birkin starred in a film in 68 called Wonderwall, which George Harrison wrote the music for, and
That's
was the
right.
first solo Beatle album to come out, called Wonderwall Music by George Harrison in 1968. But even more interesting is that Gainsbourg and Birkin had a daughter named Charlotte, who put an album out 3 years ago, and Paul McCartney wrote a song for her to sing on that album, and he actually plays every instrument on the song except vocals, and she did the vocals.
Oh, wow. That's a very cool Beatles connection. But this is one of the stranger stories we've ever done on this show, I think. You know, I'm finding myself at a loss for words about this one a little bit, to be honest, and that doesn't happen to me very often.
I just find that, I mean, it's really, again, what do you think of the song itself? Like, what's your opinion of the song?
Well, the song itself is fine, you know, but I wonder what was going through their minds. They had to predict that, I mean, maybe it was attention seeking. I'm not sure, but they had to know that it was going to get dropped or there were going to be some kind of consequences or getting it banned, right?
Yeah, they can't be that naive. I mean, Gainsbourg was saying the music is very pure, but it is. I mean, it's a very beautiful melody.
Absolutely.
But it's the vocals that kind of just, you know, distract you, I guess you could say, right?
Well, you know what? And people are going to have to listen to it on our Spotify playlist. Now, this is going to be the highest rated Spotify playlist that we've ever put out. You watch.
Well, and then it made me think, too, there's two other records that came out after it that I thought were kind of in the same vein. One was a Montreal group called The Bells. And they did a song called Stay a While. Do you remember that song?
I don't, but I'm guessing that they were probably wearing nothing but bells or what? Is that?
Well, you know, it's Montreal, right? and the other one was Donna Summer's song that was banned in the UK as well, Love to Love You Baby, which sounded pretty erotic at the time, right?
That's right. And yeah, that's actually, that's a great song.
Oh, I love it. I mean, I think she disowned it later in life when she became a born again Christian. She was like, oh, no, that song is wrong. No, it's right. And it's perfect for that. It was great. It was one of the few disco songs that I can say I loved.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly. It would fit the time perfectly, right? The time period that it came from. And now, other than songs with sex for their backing tracks, what was on the charts this week?
There was Debbie Does. No, just kidding. Bee Gees with a song that, you know what, I listened to when I was putting together the playlist and I forgot how good it is. It's a song called Don't Forget to Remember. This is the UK top five, by the way. This isn't the American. So there might be some weird stuff here. So number five was the Bee Gees. Number four was Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue.
Which is an
number
all-time
three
great
at this
song.
Time, it was going up the charts. Next week, it would be number two, was Jane Birkin and Serge Gainsbourg. Je t'aime, moi non plus. How's that for my French?
I'll give you an A for E for effort or whatever they call it.
E for effort, exactly. Number two, I love this, Bobby Gentry. Now, she only had one hit in North America, the Ode to Billy Joel. Billy Joel. But she had a number of hits in the UK, and this was a big hit, I'll Never Fall in Love Again. And number one was CCR, Creedence Clearwater Revival, with Bad Moon Rising. The same week in America, the number one song was an equally controversial song, Sugar Sugar by the Archies.
Yeah.
And I just have to tell you a quick story. Is that number 12 this week is a song called Hare Krishna Mantra, which was on Apple Records, produced by George Harrison by the Radha Krishna Temple. And when they asked George Harrison, the song's number 12, do you think it'll go top 10, number one? It'll go higher than number one, he said. Okay. It made it to number 11, by the way, just in case you're wondering. But anyways, it was a big hit in the UK.
Wow. So I think next, Aaron, we are heading to 1979, October the 10th. In Los Angeles. So we've been all over the place today, from Kalamazoo to London to LA, but let's take a trip back across the pond and see what we're talking about.
Sounds good. Do you see why we needed the extra quality cast?
I absolutely do, and I'm glad I listened. Well, here we are. It's October the 10th, 1979, and we're in Los Angeles. And Aaron, there's really nothing like the pomp and all the revelry around something like a film premiere, is there?
It's huge, isn't it? And all the, you know, the red carpet, they say, right?
That's right. Now, this was a rock and roll film that premiered, and The Rose, starring Bette Midler as a self-destructive 1960s rock star. Now, I think, you know, obviously, it was pretty obviously based on Janis Joplin, but it premiered in Los Angeles on October the 10th, 1979, and it really made a splash, didn't it?
Well, it's interesting because Janis Joplin died on October the 4th, 1970. Do you think they tried to time it that way, Tony?
I wonder. They might very well have. Mm-hmm. But, you know, nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Actor in a Supporting Role, that was Frederick Forrest. The Best Actress in a Leading Role, of course, Bette Midler. That was her screen debut, too. That's hard to believe, isn't it?
That's incredible. Hard to believe. Did you see it when it was at the show?
I was only 10.
So hey, stop doing that.
I didn't see it until later. I saw it in high school. It's been a long time since I've seen this movie. And when I saw it in high school, I had no idea that it was based on Janis Joplin, you know? But it also was nominated for Best Film Editing and Best Sound, but it's a great film. And, it just provides a whole glimpse into that, the performer who is self-destructing and doing it in front of the world, right?
Well, which is what Joplin did. I mean, may I say that it's a much better film than Beaches?
Yeah, I agree, 100%.
Midler's really good in it, first of all.
She's absolutely convincing, yep.
Fantastic, isn't she?
Oh, yeah, especially when they show her, you know, on her decline and the scenes where she's drugged out and stuff. It's brilliant.
I remember the scene where she goes into the drugstore and she's refused service and she loses it on the cashier. Just brilliant. Just brilliant.
Well, the other one that gets me is when the helicopter, I always remembered that, when she gets out of the helicopter, right, at the concert, and her two crew members are basically like lifting her out of the helicopter and basically helping her walk. But then the minute she hits the stage, she shakes them off and switches on, right? And very cool. I mean, sad, tragic, of course, but...
But I think that's Joplin. I watched a documentary about a train that went across Canada. They were doing concerts, and Joplin was part of that for a bit. She knew how to hold her own, you know?
Well, yeah, Joplin was, what an entertainer, you know, and so tragic. And again, a member of that 27 Club, right?
Now, what do you think of the song The Rose?
Well, I just remember everybody learning to play that in high school, so I got kind of sick of it, you know. Iconic, for sure. But my recollection of it is a little, like I said, I just got so sick of that song because everybody was doing that at every talent show, and you know what I mean. So
I'm a couple of years older than you. You know what song it was for me that everyone did? Was You Light Up My Life.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I was like, please stop, please.
Exactly. But you know, you would go in even to any music store at that time or whatever, and you'd hear someone playing that that high piano part at the start, right? I mean, everybody was playing that, and it was on everybody's mind. But I'd love to hear what was on the charts, though.
I just want to say that the song made it to number three, and I've not heard it on the radio probably in decades. Just saying.
Oh, me too. I can't remember, actually, the last time I may have heard that on the radio.
No, me neither. It's so weird. So this would have been 79, October, and it's interesting. I went the British route again, Tony, and I'll tell you why. It was a bit more interesting than the American charts because punk and new wave, punk was transforming to new wave. So you had still some of the old rockers, but you had like Status Quo at number five with Whatever You Want. Mm-hmm. Michael Jackson, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, which was the current number one in the USA. Blondie, Dreaming, was at number three. And of course, the classic Buggles, Video Killed the Radio Star, was at two.
Now, do you know the significance of that song?
What do you mean?
Well, that was the first song that MTV aired when MTV came on the air. That was the very first video.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Kind of prophetic, wasn't it?
Yep. That was the very first thing that when MTV went on air and they showed this video. Yep.
Wow, that's cool. I didn't know that. That's really cool. I just interviewed one half of the Buggles.
Oh, wow.
For Spill Magazine. I interviewed Jeff Downs, who's now in Yes, and he's a very lovely guy. And we talked a wee bit about Video Killed the Radio Star. He wanted to talk about Yes. number one was a new band called The Police and Message in a Bottle.
Oh, great song.
One of their best.
Yeah.
And number 11 on the singles chart was an EP by Kate Bush called Live on Stage. But this was the week where you saw people like Gary Numan, Skids, a lot of those bands. Sex Pistols were still charting in 79. So there you go.
Yeah, it's an interesting time in music, right? Because you've kind of, you know, disco was kind of on the way out. And punk is and new wave are on the rise. What a time. It must have felt, you know, like
didn't
it did.
Didn't you think that disco and punk equaled new wave?
Yeah, you can definitely see that, right? But I think, it was a little bit before my time, but I think as a teenager who may have lived during that period, it must have felt, especially when punk hit the scene, it must have felt exactly the same way that it did when Elvis Presley burst onto the scene in 1954. The whole idea that this was music that adults hated, right?
Well, I remember seeing the Pistols on TV, on the news, and my mother turned to me and said, you know, not be bringing any of their records into this house. Meanwhile, upstairs in my bedroom.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean, right? It was almost like it was, again, something that was just upsetting the establishment, and it would have felt very similar, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was just reading a book by Jethro Tull. The members of the band wrote the book, and Ian Anderson said exactly what you just said, was he had the same feeling when he heard the Pistols that he did when he heard, you know, Elvis and Eddie Cochran and all that, because he said just everything you knew got flipped over on its head, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty interesting chart, and like you say, there's quite a mix in there. Now, we have to jump back to the present, and we're going to see what the Beatles were up to, so I can't wait to find that out. Are you ready to go?
Talk about the Beatles? Me? Always.
All right, let's do it. Well, that was one of our more interesting road trips, and we even had to have the listener advisory on there, but I really enjoyed that, didn't you?
And you know, folks, we're just kidding about the listener advisory. That was just a bit of fun. But yeah, I enjoyed that tremendously. I liked going back to 1902.
Yeah, me too. And thank goodness we swerved out of the way of that horse in time. That I would have felt terrible.
And we missed the road apples too, which is even more important.
And speaking of apples, what a segue, ooh, eh? Look at that. Let's go apples to Apple Records to the Beatles. What were the Beatles up to? Shall I cue up Rick's music and find out?
Sure.
Okay, here we go.
Well, Tony, there's a couple of really important things that happened in early October for the Beatles. We'll go first to October the 5th, which was the date that their first single with Ringo, Love Me Do, was released in England. Parlophone 4949, R4949, 2 minutes and 11 seconds of pure pleasure, and it got to number 17 in the charts. It was their first single. I always joke with my brother because it's his birthday, and I always say the Beatles are much more important than his birthday. True story. So yeah, that was the first official Beatle record. We know they had recorded some stuff prior with Tony Sheridan, but this was the Beatles, produced by George Martin, October 5th, 1962, which makes, that's how many years ago, Tony, 60? Yes. Almost 60 years, right?
Yeah, 59 and change right now. It'll be 60 years next year. That's amazing.
Wow, that's just mind-boggling. The other important date is October 9th, which is John Lennon's birthday, 1940. He was born. John Winston Lennon, a Winston after, of course, the teddy bear, no, Winston Churchill. And yeah, he was born in Liverpool, and that was the start. I mean, who knows what would have happened without John and being born that day. So two really important dates. There was a lot of other stuff, too.
Well, there was.
That was going on.
Right. There was, on what would have been his 45th birthday, they dedicated Strawberry Fields in Central Park, didn't they?
Yeah. Have you ever been there?
I have. I've been there a few times, and you know, with band trips with the kids. And that was always one of the highlights. And I would always explain to them, you know, that there's John's place, like right across the street. You know, there's the Dakota Arms, right? And would talk about how the shooting played out and stuff. And they were fascinated by that. And Strawberry Fields, all of them said that was probably the highlight of their trip, you know?
It's funny. My daughter, Linda, who lives in New York, when she first year there, she went to Strawberry Fields on October the 9th. You know, just thinking that she said there was like 200 people there, 300 people, and a lot of people with guitars, and they were singing Lennon songs. And she said it was actually very chilling, you know, and very emotional. But she was glad she did it. So I wonder if this year they'll do the same thing.
Yeah, I wonder that. You know, we had on one of our trips there, we had someone there tell us that Yoko had just walked by about 2 or 3 minutes earlier.
Oh, no way.
Which, that would have been awesome. I mean, I wish I had seen that, you know, but
that would have been cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. So that's what was happening in the land of Beatles. As I say, two very important landmark days.
Oh, absolutely. And what a trip. This was our 26th road trip. So we're on our second set of 25, working towards 50. Can't wait, but had a great time this week, Aaron, and look forward to doing this again next week.
I do too. I think, you know, it's just so good to do, and just we're finding new and different things that we can talk about that we haven't talked about before. So it's so, and that makes us learn too, right? So it's really cool.
Well, that's right. And of course, before I drop Aaron off here, I'd like to thank you, the listener. Please, you know, if you feel like our show is worth sharing, don't hesitate to do that or tell a friend or two. And by all means, we love that. If you've got feedback for us, let us know. We respond to everything, and we love getting mail, emails, or, you know, comments on social media. So please do that. But here we are, Aaron. We're at your place. So have a great week, my friend.
You know, the best thing about these things is I get to spend some time with you, Tony. Wonderful time, wonderful trip. So thank you very much for driving.
Well, thanks. And thanks for the tip about the extra premium gas. That saved our bacon, I think, and saved a horse. All right. See you later.
Music for today's episode of the Wayback Music Machine podcast was written by Rick Denis. The show notes, chart selection, and Spotify playlist were created by Aaron Badgley.
And the artwork, recording, editing, and sound production was done by Tony Stewart. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to tell a friend or two. And don't forget to click follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes automatically.
And we'd love it if you would leave us a review. You can also engage with the show by going on our website and leaving us a voicemail. We may even play your voicemail on an upcoming episode.
Thanks for taking this road trip with us, and we'll see you next time on the Wayback Music Machine podcast.
Hey, turn the radio up. I love this song. The Wayback Music Machine podcast is a Stewie Tunes production.